Well, hello, hello. My goodness, what a week it has been. So, at the time of recording, this has been Easter week. And it's been lovely because I've had my daughter over here from the UK. So, we've been out and about doing different things, had a lovely day trip to Poitiers, which was wonderful. But on Saturday, I did my very first line dancing workshop. It was an entire day of line dancing. But oh my goodness, at the end of it, I don't think I've ever been so tired. I mean, you've got to remember that I spent the entire day being spoken to, yelled at in French over the microphone. And I hadn't realized just how tiring it is to try and think in a different language, especially when you're not very good at it, which I'm not. It takes me time to really comprehend what people are saying, but there just wasn't time at this workshop. You were being yelled instructions one after the other at what felt like the speed of light and expected to pick up all these steps. And there was about 100 of us, but oh my goodness, it was so much fun. And as you can imagine, as with everything that happens in France, there is always a really good food spread put on. And for lunch, oh, somebody had put together this huge, big coq au vin. And you know what? That is one of the dishes that we're going to be talking about today. And it's why I thought it'd be interesting to tell you this story. But it was absolutely divine. I don't think I've ever tasted one like it before in my life. And of course, we had crusty French bread to go with it. And naturally, when you're going to be doing more line dancing for a few hours, copious amounts of wine. I don't know how the French ever get anything done. All I wanted to do after that was go for a long nap. Anyway, it is very important to understand, which is something I understood pretty quickly when I moved to France, is that food is an experience to the French. It's an experience to savor. It is not something you do quickly. And the importance of sitting down and enjoying a meal slowly and savoring, both the food and the company is such a significant part of the French dining culture. In fact, I've been to French dinners that have lasted over 6 hours, where each course is almost like an event of its own. Not to mention that each region in France has its own very distinct color and oh God, excuse me. Not to mention that each region in France has its own distinct culinary traditions and specialities, and they're influenced by geography and history. But before we dive into the five dishes with all those fun stories behind their origin, I should just mention that it isn't just the French who think their food is amazing. French food has been recognized worldwide by UNESCO. So in 2010, UNESCO created a new list called the Intangible Cultural Heritage, and that recognizes knowledge, cultural practices and traditions instead of physical sites. Le repas gastronomique des Français, the gastronomic meal of the French, was added to this list. So, this recognition was primarily because French cuisine is considered to be, well, a social custom that celebrates togetherness, the pleasure of taste, and the balance between humans and the products of nature. I love it. It's fantastic, isn't it? And this honor highlights the importance of French cuisine in world culture and, of course, its influence on the art of cooking and dining worldwide. So the UNESCO recognition, it isn't just about the food itself, but it's also about the ritual of eating in France. And it includes things like the setting of the table, the selection of the dishes. More importantly, the pairing of the food with the wine, and then the emphasis on sharing and enjoying meals together. It's a recognition of how culinary traditions really are an integral part of the cultural identity of a country. So now you know why the French have every right to be proud of their food. But let's get on with it. Let's look at these five dishes. And I have to say, I have cooked all five of them. And I love having these at restaurants, but each one has a story behind it. Now, I've got foolproof recipes to these because if I can do it, anybody can. I am not the world's best cook. I'm not the worst, but I'm no chef. So I like to have really easy to follow recipes to keep things simple. So if you want these recipes where really you can't go wrong, just go to lifeinruralfrance.com/podcast and look for episode 10. And then you'll find the links to all the recipes as part of the show notes. And you'll see pictures of the results of my labor as well. Some prettier than others. All right, so I'm going to start off with coq au vin, chicken, rooster in wine. It is a French staple, and it is one I have tasted many times. And of course, I live in Chaix-le-Coq, so kind of fitting that I start with this one. But when I did this the first time, I decided to change things up a bit because I'd seen this recipe that gave it a bit of a twist. Now, usually this dish is made with red wine, but I did it with white. So it's coq au vin blanc. And my French neighbor and friend Anne, I've spoken about her before on this podcast, she is an amazing cook. And she told me to never be afraid to experiment. And her coq au vin blanc is delicious. Now, what actually inspired this whole cooking bout for me, and this was last year, was a new show that I just watched about this fabulous cook, Julia Child. And it was simply called, the show was called Julia. And it was brilliant. And it starred Sarah Lancashire and David Hyde Pierce. And it just made me realize it is never too late to develop a love of cooking. I mean, Julia Child herself said, "I was 32 when I started cooking. Up until then, I just ate." Oh, I just love it. So I decided to take a leaf out of Julia's book. And at the age of 52, which was what I was then, I developed a newfound passion for cooking. But where did coq au vin originate from? Well, it was a peasant dish. And originally, it was made with leftovers, and it came from the Burgundy region of France. And legend has it that it goes as far back as the Gauls and Julius Caesar. So the rooster itself was seen as a symbol of valor to the Gauls. And the story goes that the leader of the Gauls sent a rooster to Julius Caesar as a show of strength. So he was basically saying that they'd never be beaten. It was kind of a bit of a, you know, sticking the two fingers up at them. But the rooster was promptly sent back by the Romans, but cooked in wine to show that they weren't intimidated by this, and they promptly defeated the Gauls. Now, how true this is, of course, we are never going to know, but it's a great story, and it is one I am happy to go with. However, the first recorded recipe for coq au vin was in 1864 in the book Cookery for English Households. So it mirrored coq au vin, although it was called poulet au vin blanc. So coq au vin, it doesn't have lots of complicated ingredients, you'll be pleased to know. Not if you're sticking to the traditional recipe. You'll use mushrooms along with chicken, bacon, onions, garlic, cream, and the all-important wine. Now, I did pop a carrot in with mine because it just adds a bit of colour. Plus, I'd just been given some carrots straight from the garden of one of my other neighbours, Claude, the farmer. And as Julia says, you don't have to cook fancy or complicated masterpieces, just good food from fresh ingredients. Now, speak to anyone about the best French food dishes or the most well-known ones, and you're going to hear bœuf bourguignon. Or as my mum loves to say, beef stew. I don't know, but somehow beef stew doesn't sound as appetizing as bœuf bourguignon, does it? Anyway, when I made this the first time, I did debate whether to use Julia's full recipe from Mastering the Art of French Cooking, which is legendary, as we know. And in the end, I did decide against it because there was just a few too many steps. So instead, I went for a more simplified version. And it left out a few of the steps, so it kind of made it feel a little bit less daunting. But, it was still yummy as. So, where did bœuf bourguignon come from? Well, as you might have guessed, it originated from Burgundy, and again, it was a peasant dish. So it was a way to use up those tough cuts of meat that, you know, you didn't want to throw away, certainly not when you were poor. So you'd pop them in a pot, and you'd leave them to stew in their own juices along with some wine. And often these big pots would just simmer over a fire for a week or more. And different vegetables were thrown in along with other scraps, and the longer it stewed, the better it tasted. See, what you've got to remember as well is drinking ale and wine, even for breakfast, was really common years ago because the water was contaminated. So putting it in cooking wasn't really a stretch. Now, one of my other favorite Julia Child quotes, which I try to live by, is, "I enjoy cooking with wine. Sometimes I even put it in the food." Oh my God, she was a fabulous woman, a woman after my own heart. Now, the earliest version of this dish was from the 15th century, and I'm probably going to totally butcher the pronunciation of this, but it was bouilli de bœuf à la bourguignon. Now, the first recipe, however, was published in the 19th century by somebody called Auguste Escoffier. And the cut of meat that you use is actually really important. And it's not what you might think, because it isn't. You don't use the most expensive cut of meat. That is not what's going to work for this dish. In fact, it was my butcher, my French butcher, who told me that the cheaper cuts of meat are actually the better ones to use for this dish because they don't break down as fast and they're better when you're cooking over a longer period of time. Now, in France, well, certainly in Leclerc, where I shop in La Rochefoucauld, you can usually get bœuf bourguignon packs from one of the meat aisles, but I just prefer going to the butcher. You know, the meat just tends to be that much better. And besides which, I actually have a good time at the butcher now because he knows how terrible my French is, but he's very patient with me. He always corrects me, and I kind of like it. It's a nice little, you know, thing to do. But if in doubt, go for a cut such as chuck, which comes from the shoulder because it's more fatty. So it's perfect for slow cooking, just like brisket. And that would work well as well. Now, as for the wine, traditionally, you want to use a good quality Burgundy because I always kind of live by the, you know, the thing of if I would drink it, then I will put it in cooking because I'm never going to use all of it in cooking. So I want to better enjoy drinking it. That's the rule of thumb, really. Next up is moules marinières, or mussels in white wine sauce. Now, this was one of my dad's favorite dishes when he was alive, and he would always order it when he came to France. And he loved mussels in white wine sauce with cream. So moules marinières à la crème in French. Now, I grew up in Lyon-Sea in Essex. Yes, I am an Essex girl. Hold my hand up and admit it. And we lived by the cockle sheds, and we ate a lot of seafood. Every Sunday, as kids, as a family, we would walk down to the seafront and we'd come home and have a seafood feast. It was like a Sunday afternoon tradition, unless it was raining, of course. And we would indulge in everything. And Dad and I absolutely loved cockles, winkles, shrimps, prawns, mussels. And actually, the only ones I couldn't stomach, which Dad did love, were whelks. I just couldn't do those. And when I moved to France, pretty much when at the beginning, every time I ate out, I'd order moules frites, aka mussels with French fries. But they definitely varied in quality from restaurant to restaurant. So I said that one day I'd make my own. And now I finally have. And you know what? It actually wasn't that hard to do and didn't take too long at all. The longest part and the most boring part and the bit I really didn't enjoy was cleaning the mussels. Now, there is quite a bit of debate as to where this recipe originates from, but one thing we do know is that moules marinières means mariner's mussels. And mussels were traditionally part of a fisherman's diet because they ate them on their boat, and probably because they were easy to gather from the coastal shores of places like Brittany in Normandy. Now, the first version of the dish was prepared using garlic, shallots, and butter, with the wine being added, you know, at a much later stage, along with some other ingredients like cream and tomatoes. And it was during the Belle Epoque period in the 19th century that moules marinières became popular with tourists. But moules frites, which are served all around France, are said to have actually originated in Belgium, not France. Now, living in the Poitou-Charentes region, I'm only 90 minutes away from La Rochelle, which, along with its surrounding islands, is known for its mussels and oysters. I had one of the best moules marinières I've ever had when I visited the island of Île de Léron. The French dish of mouclade, also mussels in white wine sauce, comes from La Rochelle, and they use saffron and curry spices to give the dish a bit of a kick. And in the north of La Rochelle, you'll find this tiny little town of Charon, where there are approximately 40 mussels producers. So the mussels from here, they're produced using traditional techniques and they have their own official label, Moules La Charente. Time to move on to desserts. You know, it's funny because I used to be such a dessert girl, but since I've moved to France, yeah, I think I'm just an anything food girl. I can't help it. I've put on so much weight since I came to France, but oh, I just love the fact that in France, there is always a cheese course. And it's just brilliant. No longer do I have to choose between am I going to have dessert or am I going to have cheese? No, I'm going to have both. My neighbour, Alan, who is English, so we've got two English people that live on our estate, Alan and Simon, and he always laughs at me when I say that I always have room for pudding because he is convinced that all women have a pudding stomach. Well, that stomach is the one where there's always room to squeeze in dessert. And to be honest, he's probably right. But back to desserts. Tartatin is, without a doubt, one of my favourite French recipes. I mean, who doesn't love that combination of caramel, apples, and puff pastry? Now, it's no great secret to my family and friends that I have a love-hate relationship with baking. Now, I've had some whopping disasters, including some hot cross buns that I tried to make. When was it? I tried to make them in lockdown. Oh my God, they looked like bath bombs. And then I made some lemon muffins that looked like a battlefield explosion. But you know what? I am never deterred by a few little mishaps. So I have soldiered on with my baking. And I have to say, I've actually improved. So much so that I decided it was time to up the ante and try baking a tart tatin. And I wasn't even put off by the fact that you've got to cook it upside down and have to turn it over once it's done. I mean, that in itself is enough to make anyone want to run from the kitchen. And if you're wondering what the difference is between a tart tatin and an apple tart, you're not on your own because I've had this question quite a few times. But an apple tart or tarte aux pommes in French is cooked traditionally. So, it, you know, in a similar way to a pie where the pastry is filled with the fruit, popped in the oven and baked. Tarte tatin is different because the apples are cooked first on the stovetop and caramelized. The pastry is then placed on top and you cook the whole thing in the oven upside down. Now, of course, there is a story behind it. There's a few versions actually of this story, but the origin story, yeah, this one that I'm going to tell you, I think is the most popular. And it came about as a happy accident in the 1880s in a hotel kitchen belonging to two sisters called Stephanie and Caroline Tatin. So the story goes that Stephanie, who did most of the cooking, was overworked in the kitchen one day and she was making an apple pie and she'd left the apples cooking in butter and sugar. She smelt burning, tried to rescue the apples by putting pastry on top, popping, you know, the whole thing in the oven to finish it off, and then serving it upside down to her guests. It went down a storm, and it became a signature dessert of the hotel. However, it wasn't actually until the sisters died that the name Tarte Tatin was bestowed upon the dish. So I think that's kind of a nice story. It just shows, you know, every mistake can be rectified, so remember that one. Our final dish is another favourite of mine. Actually, this was quite hard to make. Crème brûlée. And it is a toss-up when I go out between this and tarte tatin if both of them are on the menu. And I love it when it's one of the options of a café gourmand. Now, if you don't know what a café gourmand is, it is one of the best things to come out of France. It's a selection of mini desserts, which it's usually served with an espresso. Now, normally with a café gourmand, Actually, I had some friends staying here last year in the summer and I introduced them to Café Gourmand and they loved it. It's seriously the best way to enjoy dessert because normally you get a minimum of three mini desserts. Sometimes you'll get up to five and obviously you get the coffee as well and the stronger the better as far as that's concerned. But it's just so good because you don't need to make up your mind what you're going to have for dessert. You have little bite-sized ones of nearly all of them. Anyway, where did crème brûlée originate from? Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. The French, the English, the Spanish, They all lay claim to being the originators of this dessert. But apparently, there's a reference to a custard dessert that had caramelized sugar on top that was burnt with an iron that dates back to the 15th century in England. Then, of course, you've got the Spanish creme catalana that's been around since the Middle Ages. But as the name itself is French, I kind of feel like I've got to give this one to France. Anyway, the story goes that it was François Masselot who discovered the dessert when he was visiting Perpignan. Now, a chef to Philippe d'Orléans, the brother of Louis XIV, François made the dessert for him on his return to Paris. So the dessert got cold before he was able to serve it. So he tried to warm it up using a hot iron, which then burnt the sugar on the top. Et voila, the first French version of crème brûlée. So it appeared in Françoise's 1691 cookbook, Cuisinière Royale et Bourgeois. So there you go. Now you know. That's how crème brûlée came about in France. And the traditional crème brûlée, which translates to burnt cream, is just really simple. But it's just difficult getting it right, getting that combination right. But it's a combination of cream, eggs, sugar, and vanilla. So in other words, it's custard. And it's caramelized sugar that goes on the top. And that's the bit that sets it apart. But it wasn't too difficult to make. There's quite a few steps that require time in between. So it's not a quick dessert. So my advice is to make it the day before. And then you've got all night then to refrigerate it. But the main tool you need for this, which I didn't have, and I love going buying little tools, was a little kitchen blowtorch. And it wasn't expensive, very easy to find in my local Leclerc, but it made me feel like a real bona fide cook. But if you don't want to get one of those, you can just put it under a really hot grill for about 45 to 60 seconds. Now, if you go this way, you're going to want to put it back in the fridge for about 30 minutes before serving because the custard goes warm under the grill. Unlike if you use a blowtorch. So it's worth getting a blowtorch. I think I got it for under 10 euros, so it's not expensive. The other thing that's worth noting is go with vanilla bean rather than the paste or essence because it makes a massive difference to the taste. So there you have it. 5 wonderful French dishes that are just full of taste and not that hard to make and all have a lovely story behind them. Now, next week, it's time for me to introduce my second guest on the podcast. And it's rather a special one because I'm chatting with another podcast host who also has a podcast all about France. So we're doing a swap and we're guesting on each other's podcast so we can both share our stories. Lulabelle of Lulabelle's Francophiles is an Aussie. And she loves all things French, and she's living in my old stomping ground of Melbourne. Yes, I lived in Australia for 10 years before moving to France. So I loved chatting all things French with her, and she shared a load of knowledge on places that I haven't been to, so and some that I have. So it was really interesting chatting with her, and she's very entertaining. She's got a lot of fab stories to share with you. So make sure you tune in to meet Lulabelle next week.